This evening I will continue, in a sense, with the second part of our explanation of the Lord's Prayer, commonly known as the Our Father. Let me remind you that we were together this evening and had reached that point which says, "Forgive us our debts as we also forgive our debtors." And we said in a way that as long as I remain at odds with this that we say in the Our Father and it has not been attended to as it ought to be, then no matter how laborious a person's prayers may be, and no matter how fervent they may be, we will have no result, because our Christ is clear on this. He is categorical, as we might say. He does not mean that we should merely come to terms with another person. Man is obliged to be reconciled with God. Do you wish, Lord, that I forgive? I will forgive. Do you wish, Lord, that I make peace? I will make peace. Do you wish, Lord, that I love? I will love. You cannot refuse to forgive and still ask forgiveness of me. You cannot refuse to show mercy to your fellow man and still ask mercy of me. And still less can you dictate to me the terms on which I should forgive you all that you owe, when in reality you yourself have not forgiven. You understand how inconsistent this is, and yet there are people who drag themselves along for many years in the Our Father, completely inconsistent with what we are saying, and God bears with them. God bears with them. I do not know whether such a person will ever turn, whether he ever seriously concerns himself with this matter. Of course, some, with God's help, have taken care not to harbor bad thoughts toward another, and have restrained themselves as much as they could. And such a person thinks he is now in order. "I am in order," he says, but what if the other man still holds no fellowship with him? What if he does not even say good morning, and so on? What concern is that of mine? But it is not like that at all if there are still people who do not have good relations with one another. A large share of the blame falls on us and on many others, because we did not play the part of peacemakers, we did not speak a word of peace, we did not take the trouble to reconcile these two sides ourselves, these parties that had drifted apart and stood divided. We did not speak a word of peace, and many times we did not take out our wallet to pay off some difference between them, some sum that is often trifling. And yet because of it, people are kept apart and will not even say good morning to one another. And this is the reason, and these are sins of the right hand. Many do not know that there are also sins of the right hand. They look only at the left. "I did not steal. I did not commit adultery. I did not wrong anyone. Yes, I did no evil," agreed. But what good did you do at the moment it was needed? What could you have done and did not do? And there are many such cases that we could have defused and did not. And that is why there are people for whom no one was ever found to admonish them, to bring them to their senses so they might understand what they are doing when they cling to the far side. People who go on hating, holding a grudge against a man who harmed them, a man who wronged them, a man who slighted them, who caused them some trouble. I do not know what. It takes only a word to be able to grasp this, that the man who stands against you is essentially a benefactor of your soul, and afterward of the eternal blessings as well. It is the wicked who help people reach paradise. Would there be any saints if there had not been this cruelty? If they had not cut off people's heads, if they had not persecuted them, if there had been no unbelievers and the rest, would there have been martyrs? There would have been no martyrs at all. The malice of the one displays the holiness of the other. To respond with evil, simply because someone else did evil first, is neither goodness nor victory. Nor can I say, as I said last night, "I do not bother anyone, but I do not want anyone to bother me." That accomplishes nothing. I want you to be good even to the wicked. Do not be good only to the good. He bothers no one, and he does not want them to bother him. No. If they do not bother you, what will you have to work with? If a man could reflect deeply on this, he would have solved many of his problems, the very ones that first of all keep him far from God. That is to say, he loses his soul in advance. And second, he himself has no peace. He cannot move freely. He feels wretched when someone speaks to him about a certain person, when they stir up some old affair, when he passes by a certain place, when he hears about someone. The man suffers. the man is tormented. And life today, which is already so exhausting, has no need of such things. They do great harm. A man must become calm, meek, and quiet. For if a man does not have these, he cannot reach the depths within himself. Go to a lake, for example, and look at the lake. As long as the surface is still, as long as the surface is calm, you can see into the depths. You can see what is down there. But when the surface is even a little bit clouded, because some thin layer has settled there, what happens? You can no longer see the depths. So it is with a man. When a man has the slightest inner disturbance, it is impossible for him to find himself. This is why Hezekiah inner stillness is given to us, so that a man may also discover the fine details of his own soul. This is why people withdraw from the world and go to stillness in order to find themselves. A man is like a battery. In the world he discharges, he is used up. He empties out. We call it fatigue. The world is bad. Life is bad. Life is heavy. And if a man does not then come back to himself, apart, to grow calm, he cannot have any strength for the next day. This is why our Christ said, "Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." And people come to great harm when they busy themselves with matters that are not of the day, matters that lie further off, where often there is even a choice to leave them alone, and not go stirring up the things that have already tormented us. So then, if we ought not to trouble ourselves over certain such things, lest we do ourselves harm, then far more should we not carry within us this gnawing worm of spite, of grudge-holding, of malice, of the enmity we speak of. The moment a person is wounded, by a word, by some phrase, by some action, the healing must come at once. The wound must not be left open. Paul himself says, "Let not the sun go down upon our wrath." "Do not let the evening come," he says, "and the sun set while you have failed to be reconciled, to make peace, to love, to forgive." A person must set these matters right immediately. You will ask me why? Because tomorrow is not promised to you. You lay down in the evening and did not wake the next day. You will grieve in eternity if you leave this world still estranged from someone. You will grieve if you never manage to make peace and to restore a bond of love. Once you are gone, the keys are no longer in the same hands. You hold one set here, and the other person holds the keys over there, and the matter stays tied in a knot and is never undone. It is easier for a man found in sin at the last hour to be loosed and absolved than for a soul that willingly departed this world in malice. And so a man gambles his eternity as though on the red and the black of a wheel, and this he must not do. He ought to study what Christ asks of a man. But tell him to read the gospel law, and he does not want to read the whole gospel. He finds it tedious. He busies himself instead with the television, the magazines, the newspapers, the programs. He is not interested. He grows weary. He takes it for fairy tales. I am not asking him to read much, only to read 3 chapters. Let him read the so-called Gospel Law, the Sermon on the Mount, which, as you know, is found in the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th chapters of Matthew, and likewise in the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th chapters of Luke. Let him read only this, and when he sets himself to read it, and at the same time to study it, to go deep into every single word, the gospel will fall from his hands. He will see that he has done nothing, and does nothing, of what he had imagined he was doing. And on the very matters I am speaking to you about at this hour, since last evening in fact, I have been reading from the evangelist Luke, from the 6th chapter. It says this, "When all men speak well of you, woe to you," he says. "If they always give you fine and lovely words, and never a hard one, woe. For so did their fathers to the false prophets. They did the very same," he says, "flattering and buttering up one another. But I say to you who hear, pay attention," he says, "to what I tell you who are listening," and he keeps repeating it. I wonder whether you have noticed that beautiful saying of his, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." That is, there are people who have ears only for show. It is one thing to hear and another to obey. We all hear, but we do not obey. So he says, "You who hear those who have ears to hear, love your enemies. Everyone loves their friends. Anyone will love a friend, even that is no great thing. But do good to them that hate you, you will do no evil, nor even speak evil of the one who hates you. Do good to those who hate you, bless them that curse you. Your first care is to be for your enemy. Pray for them which despitefully use you, those who harm you, who trouble you, pray for them. To him that strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also. And to him who takes your cloak, give him your coat as well, and do not cling to your coat. Come now once again about this very thing you are to do." If you read what Christ says and then read the books of the fathers, you will find it lived out in practice. Robbers once came upon an elder and stripped his hut bare of everything he had, but there was one garment left hanging at the back. As they were leaving, he called out to them, "You missed this one." They had overlooked it. "You left this behind," he said, and they turned back, and he handed them the rest as well. Do you understand? A hundredfold, a hundredfold. Of course, to him who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also, and from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who asks of you, everyone. Do not ask whether he deserves it or how he will use it. Who are you to judge? Give to everyone, without making distinctions. And as you want other people to do to you, you too must do the same. We want the very same for ourselves, for we want to be forgiven. We want our own child to forgive us. We fly into a rage over a hen that wandered into a neighbor's yard, yet we do not do the same when others do something against us. And if you love those who love you, pardon me, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? What merit is there in you if you love the one you eat with, drink with, and make merry with? What does that gain you? Where is the merit in it? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? If it is not truly freely given, you leave behind no real gift at all. I have laid no obligation upon you. I hold nothing over you. My hand is not left empty for what I have given. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, that you will get it returned, and with interest and the rest, what do you bring to it? You did a kindness, but even sinners do as much. Sinners lend to sinners in order to receive again the same. But love your enemies and do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. I will help you, and if things turn out so that I never get it back, blessed am I. Others will give to me instead. For in the hand of the poor man I behold Christ. When he comes to my door, call him a beggar if you will, but I call him my creditor. For I am a believer, and I pray, and I say, my God, deliver me, my God, from temptation. If we often get taken advantage of, it is because we ourselves are careless. That is the gospel. None of us paid attention while we were caught up in it, and one cunning man preys on another. These are the reasons. And so this is what is being said here, love and do good and lend, expecting nothing back from what is your own. And the Most High is kind, and so you shall be children of God, for the Son of God, Christ, makes his sun rise upon the just and the unjust, upon the evil and the good. All the little ones he pitied, all he sheltered, all he loved, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be therefore merciful, just as your Father is merciful. We have learned to measure ourselves against the wicked. We do not measure ourselves against the good. We look at ourselves while we are cunning and conclude that we are an angel. Yet next to the angels, ourself is wicked. It is a devil. Do not measure yourself against the wicked man and do not say, well, perhaps I killed one child, but others killed five. What comes of that? Because others did 10 or 15, what do you gain? Are you saved by another's wickedness? Are you covered by another man's fault? An ancient father used to say that to take up another's faults in order to cover your own is like washing yourself with mud. You took the other man's mud to wash with, and so you wash yourself in mud, you carry the other man's filth. What does it matter what the other man does? Christ does not set me to line myself up against evil and come out looking good. He sets me to become merciful like the Father in heaven, merciful. So then, do we have the likeness of a child to its father, such that we can even say our father, which is what we are speaking about at this very hour? Do we or do we not? Here's the case before us. There are people who have been in the courts for years. A religious manager in Athens had a civil lawsuit with his own brother for 45 years over a shack up in Trikala that is worth nothing now. In 45 years, he could have bought palaces. He has been in court right up to today, and I do not even know now whether that lawsuit has ended. And why? Over stones you would throw away, for that is all it is now, a little Turkish room there in some narrow alley, and 45 years of lawsuits with his own brother. And take a look around your own circles. It may be happening to you as well, and see how deceived we are, how inconsistent we are in cases like these, and whether we can even say our father, when we bear no likeness to him at all. As I was reading up on these matters, I came upon a saying of John Chrysostom on the very things we are speaking of. Listen to what he says. For a man cannot call the man-loving God his father, he says, while holding a disposition so bestial and inhuman. For if you listen to these people who over some so-called matter have never reconciled with others, who have lawsuits, quarrels, financial affairs, family and personal disputes, these are the ones holding a disposition so bestial and inhuman. This man, he says, who holds a bestial disposition, who is beastly, cannot call God his father, for he obliterates in himself the marks of God the Father. He is the very man who spoils the likeness of God the Father. The Father who is long-suffering, who forgives, who 77 times a day grants pardon to men, who rains upon the just and the unjust, who dries up the blood the murderer shed this very night, who dries up the blood the mother shed this very night, who casts down his light and covers the filth, the dishonor, and so many other things. Where then are these marks in us? The more a man claims to have God as Father, the more he has none of these marks. Instead, he has transformed himself into the bestial kind, and he has fallen away from the divine nobility. This man who calls God his Father, while in truth he is not. For when he says the bull runs wild, when the enraged ox is roused, when the man breaks down the doors, for when the bull kicks and the ass kicks, when the one man nurses his grudge and another is a glutton, when the greedy man snatches, when the scorpion stings, when the crafty man lays his plots, and the lustful man neighs after women like a stallion, how is it possible for one who nourishes such venom to send up a prayer and to call God his own Father? How is it possible? You are called a Christian, and yet what would you expect to meet from such a man? Wild beasts. But we, with these vices, are worse, for the man who has sunk into unreason has become more irrational than the beasts themselves. Take a small example. Each of them is evil in one way. The pig has its incontinence, the bull has its temper, the camel has its grudge-holding. But here in us we have them all at once, cunning and sly and harsh and licentious and on, all of it together. We are a vast menagerie. One vice belongs to one animal, but we, he says, have them all together. So how can you say Father just like that? It is precisely because a man has never studied himself. That is, he has no pattern, as we were calling it, by which to shape himself. This is not achieved through preaching. It is achieved through good conduct, through knowing how to behave. And what does good conduct produce? It forms people. Come now, you see the woman, and yet, if you have the marks of God, you have the fear of God. However much outward fear you may show, without this you have nothing at all, whatever else you may have on the outside. He never took Christ as his pattern. He takes a pattern, of course, to make a garment, to know how to sew it. He takes the pattern and sews the shape to scale, for the outer world, for society. But the world too is to blame for bearing no resemblance at all to the Son of God, so that one might understand what it means to say Father, when we say our Father. John Climacus says this about it. The meek man is the image of the good, meek and humble Jesus Christ. A man ought to be meek, and he is not meek because his ego is there. That is why he is not meek. If Christ is meek, it means that I am not there. Learn from me, for I am meek and humble in heart. The other man is not meek because his ego is there in his heart. That is why he is not meek. So the meek man, he says, is the image of the good and meek and humble Jesus Christ. Meekness is wealth beyond all telling. A man cannot even imagine it. It is a divine name. It is a heavenly gift. It is a ladder to lead man up to the heavens. But savagery and malice and grudge-holding are the mark of the demons, and they drag a man down. He has a passage here and a little further on another that answers certain people. Do you not know, he says, that fire only breeds more fire? These things have no place in Christianity. Let me pay him back in his own coin. If you put him in his place, I said this last night. Yes, you may well put him in his place, but you yourself will fall out of your own place. You can put him in his place as far as this world goes. You can get justice on your side and so on. Get back whatever he took from you and all the rest of it. Have your good name restored in the eyes of society and all of that. Christ, above all others, knew what people are like and how they behave. He saw that the trouble is not put right by a quarrel, but that forgiveness puts out the fire. These are the very things that some people lack, and it is precisely because of this that such malice exists. Have you seen the steps of the courthouses, how worn down they are? Have you seen how they have had to patch them? They have taken out the middle where people go up and down, cut it away, and laid in new marble. You can see it for yourself. And do you know what these people are? Orthodox Christians. They go to church at Pascha. They hold memorial services for their parents. They attend the divine liturgies. They come to the paraclesis of the Most Holy Theotokos, and these are the very ones who go up and down and have worn holes in the courthouse steps. Can God be mocked? God cannot be mocked. They once asked an elder, "Elder, tell us from your experience, what are the signs that a society is making spiritual progress?" And the elder said, "When you see the courthouse steps brand new, and the steps of the churches and the courtyard worn down, then there is progress." The opposite is happening. The steps of the churches are like new, and their courtyards have grown empty, and yet the steps of the courthouses are worn smooth from heavy use and have been replaced many times over. So this is not progress. It is the opposite of what they profess, and we ought to understand this. James says in his epistle, "Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." Many people make a careful examination each evening. Did they do any harm during the day? They harmed no one and said nothing that caused anyone pain. And they measure themselves by that comparison and live accordingly. But if they went to confession, what would they say? That is not the only reckoning. You must add a reckoning from the other side as well. Not only what good did I do today, but as I said a moment ago, what good did I leave undone today? And you must write that down as sin. There are people who could play a decisive role, who could smooth things over between others, who with a single word could calm troubled consciences, make peace between husband and wife, bring children to love their parents, reconcile acquaintances, and so on. And they do not do it. They simply do not do it. I am not even speaking of those who caused the trouble in the first place. I mean the people who could have set the hostility right when it arose and did not. For wisdom says somewhere, a man takes up a word against another, comes into conflict with him, and a single coal, it says, is kindled in their midst. A single coal, mark that. From your mouth comes breath. You go and blow on that coal and start a blaze. But from your mouth also comes saliva, and if you spit on the coal, it goes out. And sadly, people don't put out a bad word. They don't cover it over, a word that can start a whole fire, that can cause a rift, an upheaval. Instead, they multiply it. If the daughter-in-law said only so much, by the time noon comes, the others have added on whatever else they had to spare. Instead of saying, "Ah, a word slipped out, you're hemmed in by worries, you have little children, you get tired, you have your work to do." But it isn't only that. If the daughter-in-law says anything at all, they're the ones who come along and pick it up and carry it further. And if the daughter-in-law said this much, by midday the lady of the house has made it this much. He could have put it out, but he did not. He piled on kindling instead. It might be the mother or the father or the brother. We are able to cover certain things over. I heard some remark, why do I take it and carry it about, like the fly you spoke of that carries filth and spreads infection? When I hear it, you know what he says about you? I was standing right there. Do not listen to what people say. People will carry tales. Come to your senses and keep the good peace of your life. We tell lies, and God is by nature truth, so we too are false, and in spite of it all, we are unread and unpracticed in these things. It is truly a seedy, a spiritual torpor. That is precisely why this great chaos exists among Christians, between clergy and laity, and among the laity within society, and it is nothing but a seedy. I will tell you a story, a very cunning one, but I love it for its cunning. There were two elders, as I was reading, who had gone many years without speaking to each other. Do not imagine, children, that because they were monks, the devil does not get his hold on them. He gets hold of them, too, in his own way. For many years they had not spoken. One of them had a young disciple, and the disciple heard that his elder was not on good terms with another elder. He grieved to see it day after day, thinking, if he dies, he will lose his soul, though he is such a good man, and all over a good morning. Why should it be so? So what should he do now? How should he handle it? One day a visitor came to see the elder, and this visitor was carrying a string of dried figs. He brought, let's say, a string of dried figs as a gift for the elder. The young novice went and stole four figs off the string and set them aside in a marked spot. He prayed to Christ in the most holy Theotokos, help me, I am not capable of this. I am only your child. These are the failings of great elders. But if you help me, I will be able to bring them to love one another. The reason is that we have never prayed for God to illumine us and show us how to act so as to bring husband and wife together, how to act so as to unite brothers and sisters, and how to act so as to reconcile neighbors. And even when we did pray, for the most part, we simply carried the tale along. Rather than putting the fire out, we lit one instead. Utter indifference, and God will demand an account for it. So a festival was being held over in the direction where the other elder lived, and this one asks for a blessing that evening. He says, will you permit me to go and keep the feast over there? He says, go, but be careful. The moment you finish, do not linger with anyone. Keep me before your eyes, take my prayer, and off you go. Now on the way to where he was heading, stood the hut of the elder, his own elder was on bad terms with. In a flash, into the hut he went. Who is it now? What's that, your blessing, elder? No, says the elder. And you, what does Father Savvas say? My friend, who are you that you count me worthy to know you, and what do you want? I've heard many good things about you from my elder. And I wanted to meet you, because many times he tells me, you shouldn't have me as your elder. He's the one who should be your elder. Who came? The elder kept saying, who came? Then, who came? And he speaks these words about me. Who came? And I felt it my duty to break away from the crowd at the festival and pass by to see you. And what is more, he gave me, though he had nothing else, two figs out of friendship. And what did that elder do? He saw those figs as if they were burning coals. There is someone over there and he is setting a snare. He said nothing. That elder said nothing and let the whole thing pass. The boy said his little farewell and left, and comes back and goes to his own little elder. Give the blessing, elder, the blessing. How did it go up there? Only good, he hides his virtues. How so? I found an elder over there where I went, and so on. Far away where he cannot see you. And what is more, he gave me two figs to bring to you. Here are two more figs, and the figs were figs of friendship. He takes them, keeps them, said nothing, is attentive, set them out to eat, and so on. Time passed. Now a festival came to be held somewhere midway between the two of them. Whoever was appointed to go, the one goes, by God's providence, as an elder, and the other goes too, by God's providence, as an elder. And the moment they found themselves there in the refectory, without either one saying a single word to the other, they went and were won over and embraced and kissed one another right there. without anyone knowing who had labored to bring about their reconciliation. But as for us reaching into our own pocket to make peace, to pay the accounts, to pay for damages, you would have courts spring up. People would go off to the courts, so that they cannot hear the Lord's Prayer, but hear the wrath of God instead. Whereas if Christians willed otherwise, some damage is done, and you learn that it has gone to court. Where are you, Mr. President? Where are you, Mr. Officer? Where are you, Mr. Teacher? Where are you, Father? Where are you, my good woman? Here fire is about to break out. They will let them go before the judge. Never tell me otherwise that they could not get hold of it, and they threw away the money. We will each put in the same. How much does my lady's work come to? How much does my lady charge? Mr. Secretary, 2,000, 5,000, these, you see, come from ignorance, these acts of kindness you could have done in a day and did not, which you never do and never even suspect. That is why I say, and I repeat, it is fire for a person to say the Lord's Prayer. He may rattle it off saying, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors," and yet without our having forgiven them at all, and without our ever taking it seriously. Because in a way we are looking for satisfaction. He will have to beg my pardon, a humble pardon. We want the other person crushed in our hands, to see him down there melting away, and even then we will think twice about whether we will help and grant the pardon. So it works to my benefit to be tempted, and it works to my benefit to be wronged, and it works to my benefit that you insult me, and it works to my benefit to be the first one to ask forgiveness, because I am the one who comes out ahead. And Christ tells us this, when people quarrel over some trivial word, and Satan holds them there and will not let go, he says right in the midst of it, Christ sets a prize upon the matter, the prize of the peacemaker. Do not wait, he says, otherwise another will come and take the prize from you. And there first, he says, when the wills of two men meet, seize it. He says, seize the reward. For God says it, of the peacemaker alone, blessed are the peacemakers, not of those who are merely at peace. Nowhere else did he leave his blessed, if you will, in the way I told you. Only in this case, because just as Christ was lifted up between heaven and earth to unite man with God, so too must man become a bridge with his words, with his bearing, with his love, with his attention, with his tears, with his wallet, become a bridge uniting people in this world. For if people are not united in this world, it is not possible for them to face that other world. It is essential, and yet man does not do it. And I tell you, if not we ourselves, we who, over some chance disputes with others, hang on and drag it out while God's long-suffering waits for us, then at least for the others around us whom we know, let us find some way to be reconciled, some way to cover them over, to unite them, to be forgiven, and to love. Because otherwise neither you nor they can see the kingdom of heaven and the face of God. Great is the reward of the one who manages to unite man with man and man with God. That is it, because there are two pieces, one upward and one alongside. There are two commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with your wallet, with your whole self, and your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. People are in an agony here, where one must labor day by day to unite man with God and man with his fellow man. This is the work a person must do, whether in word, in deed, or in thought. Let us stop there for this evening. Tomorrow evening will be the final part of this exposition of the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father. Those of you who come on the other evenings will remember that we have given 5 talks, and tonight is the 6th, all of them on this prayer which every one of us recites, yet which only a few truly grasp. We do not know what we are saying, nor how great our responsibility is for the words we speak, for these are not empty words, they are the very words we ourselves are saying this evening. I dealt with the second part, the petition, "Forgive us our debts, as we forgive our debtors," and there remains the last verse of this short prayer, which, as you yourselves know, is, "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." These are the closing words. Have you ever reflected on what these words mean, the words we say, or that we hear the chanter say on our behalf? What does it mean when we say, "Lead us not into temptation"? Could the Lord ever lead a person into temptation? What does "lead us not" mean? Do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us. Save us. From the evil one, could God ever give a person over to temptation or place temptation before him? For God to lay a temptation upon someone, is that ever possible? Is it possible for God to permit a temptation to a person, but to which person? To the one who does not tempt himself, to such a person. I only want to say this to you, for us this verse has no application today. We have no need of it, because we ourselves create temptations for ourselves. We need no one to tempt us. We are tempted by our own selves, by our ego, by our self-interest, by our flesh, by our own world. And if this verse were not in the Our Father for the congregation of today, it would say nothing to us, and nothing would be lost. The temptations that are permitted by God are for the saints, for those whom God knows must be tested, so that they do not fall, or so as to heal in them something they are not even aware of, something they ought to confess. For the temptation born without complaint, when a person suffers a temptation without a murmur, an affliction, a persecution, when he carries a cross without grumbling, this covers a multitude of sins, sins of which we are not even aware and therefore cannot confess. But, in general terms, God has no need today to tempt a person in order to guard him from some fall or to heal certain weaknesses of his. For a person on his own, far from God, taking no account of God, not reckoning with God as he ought, is tempted by his own self. And so God takes no part in that temptation. Now, I was reading in the Gerontocon that a demon once appeared to an elder and said to him, "How strange you people are!" And the elder asked why. "Do you see that man there?" says the demon. "I see him," said the elder. "That man," he says, "does whatever I tell him. Whatever I say, he does." And then he goes off and recites the Our Father and says, "Lead us not into temptation. Lead us not into temptation." "And that is exactly how much good it does," says the demon, "for whatever I tell him, that is what he will do." "So what use is it now," he says, "to recite the Our Father? And it is true what I am telling you, that a person today is not tempted by God. Do not lay it upon God. All the crosses that a person bears, the affliction, the adversities, and the rest, all of these a person makes for himself." That is why I repeat that this last verse perhaps has no place in the Our Father today. Paul says that God permitted a thorn of Satan to buffet him so that he would not be exalted, and gave him an illness, an incurable one at that, even though he begged many times for the illness to be taken from him. He did not take it from him. He left it with him, so that he would not be exalted on account of the many revelations. It is true that in the case of the saints, God permits them to enter the fire so that they may become more radiant. Did Job have to be tempted by the holiness this man possessed? He should not have been, and yet he was tempted, and not simply tempted, but tempted sevenfold, a temptation of such a kind that we would have taken our own lives had we been in his place. And yet he was tempted. Did he suffer any harm because he was tempted? None at all. He became better. From every temptation a person grows wiser, comes out better, comes out more composed for the struggles to come, and more skilled thereafter in contending with Satan. If you read the book of Job, who is the very professor of temptations, as we were saying, you will find this. In its 42nd chapter, the last of his book, he says, "Once he had been restored, until now I had heard of God only by the hearing of the ear. From what I had heard, I believed that God exists. But now mine eye seeth thee. After these trials of 7 years, I now see him," he says, "God himself." It is one thing to hear about God. I want you to see God. For the Christian who is tested by God and sees the plan of God. If a person wishes to see, if he is being tested by God, that is, if he has entered into temptation, into the examination hall of trials, whether by the evil one or by his own self, he ought to read a passage of Paul, written to the Corinthians in the 10th chapter of the first epistle. There Paul says this, "There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man." The temptation, he says, which is permitted by God is only so great as a person is able to bear. For as the apostle says, together with the temptation, God also provides the way out. He cuts, but he also heals and soothes the wound. If you find yourself facing a temptation, a difficult situation in your life, something so heavy and unbearable that it brings you to the point of suicide and despair, know that you have brought it upon yourself. And you did not know how much you were loading onto yourself. Just as a mother and a father know how much weight to let their children carry, in proportion to the age and the strength of each one, in exactly the same way God knows how much temptation He should allow to each person. If people are deeply grieved and reach the point of despair, it is because they themselves created the temptation. I have people who are dressed in mourning black, and not over a death. Why? One asks, did the daughter's marriage break up? Why did she separate? Well, the groom turned out to be no good. And where did she find that groom? Did God give him to her? You see, we blurt out from time to time, as God willed, but did she ask God? Did God give her the groom? Or did she take matters into her own hands and take him herself? You did not ask God, that is the truth. And now you say that God gave you a person you cannot bear today, who lies, who blasphemes, and who piles sin upon sin. Out of 1,000 people who come to marriage, it would be a great deal if even one asks God and waits on God for the husband or the wife. The other 999 of us put in our own hand, moved by our ego, by our own interest, by our flesh, and God has no part in it. God is simply called in to bless the marriage. And often, it is not a marriage He is asked to bless but fornication, and only in a few exceptional cases is it otherwise, so that we may not speak in absolute terms. And even so then, once you're left on the street with a child or two, God gets the blame. God allowed the temptation. Quarrels, courts, obstacles. And now the woman is left gathering it all at home. Work, torments in the house. She carries them alone. Why? She is bearing a cross. She has been dragged into it. But truly did God give her this. She made this cross herself. I mean that we know how it came about. And if there is one matter that comes to my tongue, and I will offer it as an argument where God truly must be asked, it is in everything, of course, but above all in this. Because no one knows which one is his own rib. Only God knows which is the rib of Adam. Only God knows which is the rib of Eve. That is why so many couples are ill-matched and have no harmony, because they did not ask God. And as the church beautifully says through the proverbialist, house and property fathers apportion to their children, but from the Lord a wife is fitted to a man. People do not know this, nor do they want to hear it at all. And then we have one shipwreck after another. Know that of every 100 couples, 60 or 70 today are shipwrecked, and 20 or 25 are battered and broken against each other, and only 3, 4, 5% hold together and have some real understanding between them. Why? Because they did not ask God. This is a cross. This is a temptation. This is a great affliction in the family in general. Ah, but the man made it himself. Or rather, he did not make it. He was simply never asked. The disputes, he says, over the fields, over the inheritance from the father, house and property, the father's apportion. The plot of land comes from your father, but your wife will be given to you by the angel from the Lord, a wife is fitted to a man. And we say to the priests, you just sign, I do not want anything from you, you only crown us and hand us over. Many times we stand in crownings we do not deserve, because more and more we come to marriage without honor. Honor today has almost no connection with marriage. Out in the countryside, there is still some reverence left. The mystery is reckoned and taken seriously. But in the towns, virginity has been all but cast aside, both by the man and by the woman, and the priest speaks falsely when he says, crown them with glory and honor. What honor is there to grant them? What glory is there to grant? People do not know that it is the church that gives the crowns. They are not taken from the market, the ones we buy. Out in mountainous Evrytania and elsewhere, the church keeps the crowns. In some places they are of iron and in others of vine branches. And you crown the man and the woman who struggled and came to their wedding as virgins. The crowns are for them, for those who struggled and came pure to the marriage celebrated in the theanthropic church, the church that is both divine and human. And from that point on, the church blesses them to come together with one another lawfully, so that they may multiply for the bearing of children. No one gains anything by clinging to such things. Filthy as they are worth nothing at all, Lord, and they are worth nothing to anyone. So there are many temptations, I say, and you know them yourselves today. In your own surroundings, take Mr. So-and-so if you like. How many such cases there are? Homes. You see a house that was once full of smiles and joy turned into gloom and into a game of hide-and-seek. You want God? You are not God. You want God, but you never asked God. You never even said, Lord, I will give an account to God. You just went ahead on your own. We signed our marriage over here. Our business grew, and we will live. But you cannot live without me, because far from God there is no happiness at all. Near God there is, even if this does not settle well in our minds, and we cannot fully explain it. And this is not the only temptation we create for ourselves. There are many temptations. I met a lady one day whose eyes were burned from weeping. How are you, I say? What has happened to you? A fine, respectable woman. We are breaking up, she says. Why, I say, because, she says, I did not listen to you. And how was I even to grasp what had already taken place? Her young daughter had once stood as godmother, as a girl, to a small child at St. Spiridon in Corfu. She went there to the church, and they baptized the child at St. Spiridon. She had a young girl with her, took the child, set the girl as godmother, and had her baptize it. So this godson has now grown up, and he has come to Athens, and he comes to study in Athens. In Athens, this widow had three daughters, and she took the young man into her home to live there. She brought him into the house without any concern, but he is our godson, as though the devil cares about godsons, or any such nonsense. The result was indecency and nakedness, and so on and so forth. A father with a child, who brought this whole thing about, who reared it, who tended it all the way from his homeland and made it his own. And the child is a spiritual child. How is a spiritual child to take his own spiritual mother? How is he to take her? Who and on what grounds would bless such a thing in church? Yet it happened, they became engaged, and so on. Another strange thing, within 5 months, divorce. Who is this God? Did God yoke them together? A temptation came upon the family. Did God send it? No. We brought it on ourselves with our own hands. Young men come to blows every day. Young women come to blows every day. They get scooped up by the police vans and all the rest. A great temptation, a torment bound up with it. And you ask, who did this, Christ or the Most Holy Theotokos? They see their daughters too out with some fellow until morning, drunk, and they don't know what they did. And all those who get picked up in the morning by the police from the nightclubs, and God is to blame, and then there is temptation in the house, the mess they bring home. Is God the one who makes that? God does not make these things. The petition, lead us not into temptation, I repeat, has no place in our life today, the way we have made that life. There are few people who are careful, who show reverence, who weigh things and take account of them, and God will often permit a temptation precisely so that the person may come out of it even better. Someone will say, those who do not know the deep love of God at work around a person or a household do such things. So why would God permit a temptation to a wicked man that he might turn back? That I understand, but a righteous person, a good man who fears God, who day and night has Lord have mercy on his lips, who is so careful he will not even tread on an ant. Why should such a man be tempted? John Chrysostom has a fine word on this. He says that the one who claims the righteous ought to have no temptation, says nothing other than that an athlete ought to have no opponent. Whoever says that a righteous person should not have affliction is like saying that an athlete should not have an opponent. But for an athlete to win and be crowned, they have to have an opponent. This is what the affliction of believers is. A believer's affliction is their opponent, the one who wrestles with them so that they may win. When a person isn't tested, and many people don't pay attention to this, they don't want temptation. When a person isn't tested, he stays raw, unripe. He isn't fit for the kingdom of heaven. A person has to be tested, as I said earlier, sevenfold like gold in the furnace of afflictions, but don't go making the affliction yourself. Do not make the tribulation for yourself. Take our own case. The protector is gone. How the breadwinner left, why he left, to be killed in the war or to be lost. I did not go of myself. They came, they called me, I went, I was killed. The house was left desolate behind him. That house has its temptation. That house is called to bear this temptation, which came upon it for reasons you know, and not by its own doing. I did not bring it on. I am not the guilty one. I am working at a job. They dismissed me from the job. Now I have a temptation. I am out of work. I am tormented. I grieve. I am ashamed. I fall into debt at the market. I cannot face the grocer, the baker, the bare necessities. Yet this is a genuine temptation. I did not bring it on. But if they dismiss me because I lied, because I stole to squander it with my girlfriend, that is another matter. This temptation I made all by myself. It isn't a temptation that was handed to me from somewhere else. It's a temptation I built with my own hands. This kind of temptation can even land me in prison. This kind of temptation can drive me all the way to taking my own life. There are many things it can do to me. For, as our forefathers used to say, once one evil is set in motion, countless others follow. You know what sin is like when Satan gets us into his hands? It is like an avalanche. Imagine a high mountain covered with snow, and at the very top, high above, a tiny bird passes by and dislodges just a little snow. And that little bit of snow, as it comes down the slope, brings more with it, and it grows and grows and grows and grows and grows, and down it comes, and a single avalanche destroys the whole landscape. It begins with one sin, and that is the temptation. The sinful act carries a person along. But who is it that creates the temptation? When it is a temptation that we did not bring on ourselves, that temptation can be borne. And besides, God will find ways to help you in the midst of that temptation. Let me give you an even simpler picture of the matter. You know how a person is when he is pressed. He is like Joseph in prison. Remember how he would not give in to that shameless mistress of his and sin with her. And the young man fled, and she caught hold of him by his garment and kept his garment in her hand. And she showed it to her husband and said, "This filthy boy you brought into the house, look what he tried to do to me today, only he couldn't. Was I to hold him back? All I managed to keep was his coat." But it was nothing of the sort. The young man was running away from sin, and it was his cloak that stayed behind in her hands. The man grew angry and threw Joseph into prison. Into the inner prison, it says. Read it for yourselves. It is there in Genesis, the inner prison, and of course unjustly. Joseph had only tried to guard his master's honor, and even to guard his mistress herself. For Joseph had said one true thing, a thing that sadly certain wives and certain husbands never keep in mind. Do you know what he said? "Listen, my lady, here in this house, I am the one who runs everything. Everything belongs to my master. I manage it all. I send things out. I gather everything in. I put money aside. I, my master," Joseph says, "has no idea what he owns or what he has. I manage everything, and I am the one in control of it all. Only over you I have no authority. You belong to my master." If only wives understood this, if only husbands understood it, that a husband's body is not his own, nor his mistress's, but his wife's. And if wives likewise understood that their body is not their own, nor their friends, their adulterers, but their husbands, they would spare themselves a great deal of grief. So the poor young man suffers. They have thrown him into that place. And what does Scripture note there? One small detail, that God extended mercy into his heart. God extended mercy. "For this is pain I go, unjustly, to guard myself, to keep the law of God. and for that very thing I suffer. It is pain to a grieving man, and it drives him to despair. Where, after all, is God? God, it says, extended mercy into his heart. His pain is softened, God softens the pain. God grants patient endurance to the man who is being tried, so that good may come out of the temptation. So if God permits a temptation that we did not fashion with our own hand, then we are blessed people, and this evening I will come to the other vivid images concerning Macarius the Great. About Macarius the Great, besides what I already told you, when he saw that couple living the dog's life our own people live today, so that any sense of shame is dead and gone. On another occasion, Macarius the Great was going down to Alexandria with his disciple, and they came upon a woman wailing there on the road. The young man, the disciple, said they should stop and speak with her. The elder said, "No, she is a woman, my child. We should speak with a monk. God will send someone else to attend to her." But the young man, moved with compassion, insisted she is a human being, an image of God, and so on. The elder gave in and turned back. They came to her and saw her with her head bowed, weeping, wailing without end, and the elder gently touched her and said, "Tell me, what is the matter with you? What is wrong?" She would not speak. She went on weeping at the same steady pace, and all the more. "Tell us what troubles you. We are human beings like you. Perhaps we can help you somehow, do something for you." Still she would not speak until at some moment she lifted up her eyes and said, "My elder, my doctors, go on your way. You cannot help me. But why can we not help you? We will send someone else who can. Go on your way. You cannot help me. God has abandoned me." "But that is blasphemy," he said. "You say that God has abandoned you, yet I can see your chest rising as you breathe, as long as your chest still rises with breath. This is God's assurance that he is waiting for you. That is why we also write, and I forgot to mention it, let no one ever despair. Let no one ever tell himself that everything is closed off for evil. Whatever may have happened, however great the sin, however tangled the affairs, as long as you are still breathing, it means that God has inclined toward your case, provided only that you entrust yourself to him." The two of them could not fathom her. "Has God abandoned me, do you see? Or did they want to learn something, as if God were dealing out two kinds of abandonment?" And what did she answer? "3 years, my fathers," she says. "3 years I have gone without receiving a single temptation." And she wept. Many of us, over a single temptation, lose our voice, lose our very heart's strength. Yet this woman wept and wailed, because for 3 whole years no temptation had come upon her. That is, she had not fallen ill, had not suffered loss. No one had wronged her, and so on. And this told her that God no longer had any dealings with her. It was a great lamentation. What do we know of such things, and how little do we want them? So do not think me strange for saying it. Temptation is indeed an ugly thing. Pain is an ugly thing. Sickness, want, unemployment, persecution in general, an ugly thing it is. And Christ our Lord showed this very thing when he came face to face with death, and said as a man, "Let this cup pass from me, yet if the Father's will judges otherwise, let it be done as you will." He had the power to say, "Let it be done," and what came to pass, as you know, in this. He revealed the weakness of human nature. Human nature does not want temptation. It does not want temptation because there is always the chance that a man may fall if he is not watchful. For a temptation is a load, and when you load a man down, the burden can sweep him off many times like a shove. It is a vehicle. Just as praise is a vehicle for a fall, so too temptation is a vehicle for a fall, and a man may grow resentful, a man may blaspheme, a man may curse and say, "Cursed be the hour." What can I say? His soul lost its bearings. That is why Christ placed those words there. Ask God not to permit temptation, but to guard you from the snares of Satan, who may harden your heart and bring you to such despair that you blaspheme God and lose your soul. For that is where these things can lead. You will notice, you will find a place where a man asks God for an accounting and says to him, "Why do the unjust prosper and why do the righteous suffer? Do you not see what is going on?" And the Lord answers him thus, I who fashioned the ears, I who fashioned the eyes, I who fashioned all things, do I not know, he says, how these matters stand and why I do this. A man ought not to intrude into the affairs of God. Consider what the Troparion says. O bottomless abyss of riches, how countless are the ways you have, ways altogether beyond the reach of the flesh and of a man's self-will, so that no one can enter into the nous of God and measure how great God is. Holy men have come to a hard hour, even one of the stature of David. Read Jeremiah in the 12th chapter, where he all but challenges God. Tell me, he says, why do all their herds bear fruit? Why do the children of the ungodly go forward? Why do they hold such wealth, and so on? Please, tell me the reason why. And of course the person demands explanations. He is troubled, he is scandalized, he is shocked. Unless he has the humility to say that God stays silent about it, and holding the thought that God stays silent, that even out of this evil he can bring forth good, just as he brought life out of death and resurrection out of the tomb. In exactly the same way he can bring good for me as well. And it is true, it is true. We ourselves do not want the temptation, but when the temptation is from God, that temptation is salvific, because the things it brings us on our road, the temptation does not hand them to us easily, smoothly. And God says, when the waters flow freely, they yield only a little here, but when you put pressure on them, they bore upward and reach the heavens. So it is too with people's prayers and with the human heart. When a person is pressed hard by circumstances, when the doctors give up on them, when the wallet gives out, when their strength gives out, when everything gives out, then they turn to God. Otherwise, they keep looking down at the ground like an animal, even though they were made to look upward. Temptation, then, is a good. Right now, I only want to tell you from my own personal experience that it is a great wisdom which a person cannot grasp. Once in this life, when I was returning, or rather returning to Christ, I was put through a trial of some 5 years, a trial of estrangement from my very self, of estrangement from all that I knew, from myself and from everything. And I could not interpret what those holy men, who had a certain gift, as I am telling you, were doing. I tell you, imagine seeing a distance of just 1 meter, when I could jump 100 meters, yet I could not jump that single meter. I could not get across from here. The prayer, they go on and on and on, and they turn me around, and it carries me and carries me and carries me across, right to the place I want to reach. Now the man who is guiding me came back and turned around, and I said to him, what need was there to circle around so far to get through? Couldn't we simply have gone straight from here to there? What you are going to learn down here, he told me, is not something that can be learned here through study. That is a profound saying, and it is true, as others also say, that until a person has passed through temptation, he is like clay that has not been fired. Even a single drop of water falling on it will dissolve it. Put that clay into the fire and let it be baked. Let it become a brick, for example, or a roof tile. But it must be fired, it must pass through the flames. After that, even if seas wash over it, they neither affect nor damage it. It becomes watertight, and people can build houses with those bricks and roof tiles and live safely inside. Why? Because I passed through the fire. Listen to this thought, which is not my own, but the way this holy man has expressed it, the brick, if it is not baked by fire, it remains weak. If the brick is not baked, if it is not fired, it is useless, and it cannot endure the assault of the rains. It simply cannot. If water falls on it, the water will dissolve it, even a few drops there, and it comes apart. It is broken down by the water. But if it is baked well, then whatever is tested becomes secure, becomes strong, and the wall built of it does not give way, but stands as a wall that nothing can pass through. And having become a barrier against the liquid nature of the waters, it stands secure and even scorns the fire. When a blaze breaks out, the bricks are not touched, the tiles are not touched. It stands secure and scorns even the fire. So too the hearts of men, once they have been fired in the furnace of tribulation and tested. Not only do they easily repel the assaults of the demons, but they even smile at the flames of the furnace and count them as nothing at all. We do not want affliction, yet affliction, as the fathers say, is always winter, but winter heralds the coming of spring. If you desire an eternal spring, then pass through this present winter with purity, fighting amid afflictions. Sorrow, he says, forgive me, I have not noted down which father this comes from. In any case, it is what I am telling you. It is now true that in his sorrow a person wants help, and this is the point I want to dwell on. Some people, unfortunately, just as I said last night about the matter of reconciliation, do not stretch out a helping hand to reconcile one person with another and people with God, and so, in this case too, they take no share in the other person's temptation. When the temptation is divided into pieces, they carry it as a very light yoke. Sorrow, when it is shared out among many, says the divine John Chrysostom, is suffered with far less weight. It bites less, he says, once the sorrow is divided, but we take no share in another's tribulation. Paul used to say, who is in pain, and I am not in pain? Who is grieved, and I am not grieved? Who is made to stumble, and I do not burn? Let us say that he went about his life, then returned home and prayed on that person's behalf. In his petition and in his mind, he carried that person's path and situation, the person undergoing temptation, whether he had fallen into the temptation through his own doing, whether God had permitted it, or whether it came about in some other way, I do not know. And what other factor is it that laid this temptation on him? For when a person gives thought to another's situation, to his torment, to his sorrow, and the rest, he himself receives great blessing for his own affairs from God, a great blessing. Christ himself, on that night of his trial on Holy Thursday, asked his disciples to remain with him for 1 hour, that difficult hour, and he turned and found them, sadly, fast asleep, and he was grieved. And he says, I would have wanted you to stay with me this 1 hour tonight. And then, of course, he said that the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. We unfortunately do not take this seriously to heart, and we send people off with a single kind word. Go, and may God help you. If you can help, then you yourself help. Do not wait for it to come from heaven, because the things that exist here on earth do not come down from heaven. We are not in the age when the manna rains down. The means are here on earth. We can join hands and help one another in times of temptation. I cannot help him by myself when he is being thrown out onto the street, when he needs an operation, when he must travel abroad, or when he needs to find 5 units of blood. I can't kill this beast on my own, this trial, but 5 or 10 of us together can kill it. Pick up the phone, call so-and-so, call that lady, call this one and that one, and with just a few words you'll have put a stop to it by Saturday. We have an urgent matter, a financial one. Let this cause be helped. But unfortunately we do not offer ourselves, and the trials in the world are great, apart from the ones God permits, which, as I tell you, hardly exist today because we bring temptation on ourselves. But for the rest, these are ordeals we could have helped with, and it would be a great blessing, because God wants this very thing. This is what is called organized philanthropy, organized charity. Remember the paralytic, 8 hands, since 2 could not carry him, nor even 4. 8 hands were joined together, and 8 feet were joined together, and they opened their wallets too, and they broke open the roof of the other man's house, and lowered him down, and they made the man well, and lifted him from his bed, and took the ordeal off of him. Have we ourselves done this? We do not do it. Yet God does not want this very thing. It is written in the gospel, and there will be pangs of conscience in this. In Christ, at the last they will feel it. And for this you will take up a collection for me. Yes, I will take up a collection for you, and receive it gladly. And it is not that we want to humble you, but that God should accept it. God will accept the collection. Is it true or not that the ladies out of their own possessions ministered to the work of our Christ? It is true, Luke writes it. Certain ladies came forward and gave us some, and the company of Christ, as it went about its way, was provided for, and the people labored. They did not even have money to pay the tax. He sent Peter to the sea to cast his line because he wanted to bring up enough to pay the tax. "Cast for a fish," he says, "the first one you draw up," and inside its mouth he found a coin, and with it he paid the tax. And the ladies would supply this very thing. This is what that organized philanthropy is.